Net. Craig, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. We're just a few seconds away from 6 o'clock. Coming up next is Bread and Roses.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Hey there, good evening. Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. I'm your host tonight, Pamela Santos. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression, all this, and we have fun. We want our bread and roses too, get it? So our engineer today is Jenna Yokoyama. Hey there, thanks. We have in the studio live today, we have folks from the Decanon Project, is not only the founders, but also collaborators included. And just to tell you a little bit about Decanon, Decanon is a visibility project, a pop-up library and web resource project that's showcasing literary art by writers, artists, and artists of color. Their goal is to put forth an alternative literary canon, or multiple canons, that are inclusive, diverse, and multi-storied in their approach to representation. Decanon wishes to challenge existing ideas of what constitutes the North American literary canon, especially in our current culture. And before I keep going into this exposition overload, I just want to welcome everybody by name, and then I can make them uncomfortable for a minute while I talk about their bias. So we're going to start off on my right in front of me. We have in the studio Dow Strom.
Hi.
Neil Cannon. Why am I saying Neil Cannon now? See, this is how I was so ready. I was so ready for it, but I actually kind of want this to be your alias. Neil Aitken. I'm going to save that one for you. I think you should check into hotels as Neil Cannon, private PI. And Shayla Lawson.
Hi.
And then because I have decided to nickname Neil, I'm going to, so I can say his name over and over properly, I'm going to actually tell you a little bit more about Neil Aitken. Neil Aitken, the Canadian poet, editor, translator, and creative writing instructor of Chinese, Scottish, and English descent. He is the author of two books of poetry, Babbage's Dream, which I'm holding, well, we have it in here, published earlier this year, and The Lost Country of Sight, which won the 2007 Philip Levine Prize. A former computer games programmer and Kundiman Poetry Fellow, Neil holds a PhD in literature and creative writing from the University of Southern California, as well as an MFA in creative writing from the University of California, Riverside. He is a founding editor of Boxcar Poetry Review, administrator of Have Book Will Travel, an editorial board member of Poetry East West, and also, I will acknowledge this, a very good lumpia roller. I'm qualifying the very good.
New business cards coming out soon.
Yeah. Dow Strom is the author of Grass Roof, Tin Roof, a novel, The Gentle Order of Girls and Boys, a book of novellas, and We Were Meant to Be a Gentle People, a hybrid forms memoir accompanied by an album, East West. Her work explores hybridity through melding disparate voices, written, sung, and visual, to contemplate the intersection of personal and collective histories. She has received support from the Regional Arts, Culture, and Council, the National Endowment for the Arts, and most recently a 2016 Creative Capital Artist Award. And something new, something recent.
I have a poetry book forthcoming from Ajar Press in fall 2017.
Congrats.
Thanks.
Okay. And last but not least, we have Shayla Lawson. And this is because parentheses. Shayla Lawson is and, or at times has been, an amateur acrobat, an architect, a Dutch housewife, and dog mother to one irascible hound. Her work has appeared in print and online at Tin House, Grandma, ESPN, Salon, The Offing, and we're gonna get to the rest of this because I'm skipping to the forthcoming I Think I'm Ready to See Frank Ocean. She is the 2017 Oregon Literary and McDowell Colony Fellow and a member of the Afro-Latian Poets.
Afro-Latian.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And for that, yeah, thank you. Thank you, all of you, for joining us in studio today.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What's been great about how Bread and Roses, for all these years, you know, it's almost 40 years, there's always a time that we can bring in writers and artists just straight into the studio. And so what we have, we're going to be talking about the Duchanan project, but also pretty much as the better, I would say, illustration of this work, having live readings as well. So before we get into live readings and some excerpts from some online readings, let's just first talk about how Duchanan started.
Okay.
Okay.
How do you want us to start?
I mean, did it come from just a conversation, something happening between you, Neil, and Dal together, just talking about this?
Well, I guess it started kind of, our first conversation was really about teaching. Both Neil and I are or have been writing teachers, creative writing teachers, and teaching independently, so, you know, not at institutions. And I had been online writing teaching for quite a while. And so I guess we had this question or this idea of if we could start something like a teaching collective that was made up of writers of color who were also teachers, and if coming together would kind of help us to build that community of teachers. So that was kind of one of the first conversations that we were having. And then it kind of evolved into, like, what else can this project be? Or there were other people that we were also meeting with, like Jenny Chu came and Jamandria Harris was there at one meeting. So we were just talking about this concept. And do you want to weigh in on how the name D. Cannon came?
Actually, I'm trying to remember how the D. Cannon. I think part of what happened was we were having this discussion about maybe some of the shortcomings of people's experiences, past experiences in writing programs and workshops, and the general sense that it was very rare that people encountered work by other writers of color, whether it was in the classroom on a syllabus or just in the workshop itself. And we discussed then about canon and started to think about what would happen if there existed some range of alternate canons out there that encompassed the work of writers of color that we know exist, but we don't always see present in our spaces.
And I think we were reacting to some of the dialogue that's been going on, and there's articles out there just about MFA programs often being very white and very dominated by the Western canon, and how that can be really alienating to writers of color. So that was a starting point. And then the idea for a library kind of evolved and just like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have a space or to have, you know, where we could gather these like books, like some of them are published by small presses that are hard to find. And so we conceived of the project for this particular, for D. Cannon, that was funded by the Precipice Fund, as an art installation project. So a pop-up library in the form of an art exhibit, which, you know, crossed us over from just being a literature project to also an art project.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the gallery, where it's at for this month?
Una Gallery is downtown, 328 Northwest Broadway, Unit 117. It's right on the corner of Flanders. And that is also a project that is a Precipice Fund grantee project. And it's run by two people who are specifically centering the work in the gallery on POC, femme, queer, marginalized artist.
I was lucky enough to be there for one of the events, and I got to see the exhibit, and this is an installation. So there's quotes that are painted along the walls, it's on both floors, so there's two floors.
Yeah, there's two floors. There's one, like the upper floor is a little bit like a loft, so there's a balcony and you can look over, and we have some quotes, like poetry, on the walls, and then we have a set of bookshelves that were specifically kind of designed with this modular design in mind, so that there are these small boxes that are kind of stacked together to create this interesting object, and different sized and different, some of them only hold one book. So
we also are very lucky to have the Acemic writing scrolls from Sam Rojas Tra, who's a Eugene-based writer and artist. And some of these are very large scrolls that are rarely exhibited in their entirety. In fact, even given the space we have available, we can't even display the full length of some of these scrolls. But they're absolutely beautiful.
It's on the first, so it's on the first floor. When you first come in, you see right as you get in, on your right, those scrolls mm-hmm. by Sam. And so is this the majority of his collection that he brought in, or not even at all?
Because I feel like,
he has poetry and his Essemic writing is almost like siblings. So when he's writing this, he's also making those scrolls. And so that's interesting to see in that one space too. And so it's multidisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. And I think Sam's a good example of just like kind of to talk about the fact that the exhibit and this project is about books, but it's also kind of about literary expression in hybrid forms. And we feel that pertains in particular to artists of color. Like there are a lot of writers of color and artists of color who are working in multidisciplinary fashion. And I guess like it has to do with that a lot of what people are doing is hard to categorize. And in our curation of the whole project, we were thinking about literary expression as far as like it could be not just books, but in different modes. So words, music, visual, and even physical, like interaction.
And this movement. Is, I mean, we just talked a little bit about kind of visual art, mm-hmm. but you mentioned music. And so this is the collaboration that you have with Shayla.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me more about that particular event that's going to be later this month?
We have one of our events that's happening on August 19th is a music and poetry night, and it's going to be a performance specifically of artists who work at the intersection of music and poetry, and Shayla is one of those people. Do you want me to name the other people that are in the
Absolutely,
list?
Absolutely, yes.
Shayla Lawson, Trevino Brings Plenty, Anna Vo, Tron 444, and myself are all going to be performing.
That's great. It's great. And Shayla, I'm learning something new about you with the music. So what kind of work do you do? Because I didn't know that part about you.
So I think sometimes the ways that hybridity ends up showing up is that you start working in a lot of different facets. So, you know, I'm just learning about this music side of myself as well. This is new for everybody. I tend to work in a fashion that I will do whatever serves the project. So I am finishing up a collection will be out in 2018. It's called I Think I'm Ready to See Frank Ocean. And one of the things that I do when I perform the poems is I sing the songs as a composite to what's happening in the poems, or vice versa, that I'm responding to Frank Ocean in terms of text and music by creating these covers that are also interlaced into the poems. And so that's what I'll be doing for Decanon on the 19th.
I'm trying to hold back right now my Frank Ocean fandom because I have many questions. Many questions.
I'm always trying to hold back my Frank Ocean.
Before we went on live, we both brought up the Easter egg on an episode of Insecure where we saw a Frank Ocean iPhone or a phone cover.
It's a phone cover.
Like immediately, it's like, oh no, that's Frank Ocean.
Yes. If anybody knows where it is, Twitter at me.
Yes.
I need answers.
Part of this I'm interested in is I look at this, I have only one question that I'll leave, that it's very Frank Ocean right now, but how were you developing this particular project, and then all of a sudden Frank Ocean actually came out with a new album?
Yeah, and not just one too. So it was interesting because my book was accepted for publication in 2015. It was a very different Frank Ocean world at the time. And just based on circumstances that had nothing to do with the ocean, the publication date got pushed back. And I was a little frustrated with that because I thought, well, this is the perfect time because there is no Frank Ocean catalog happening. And then lo and behold, we get this, you know, bounty of music that I had to then respond to. So Over the course of the last year, I've added two entirely new sections to the book. So it's become this grandiose Frank Ocean compendium.
Oh my gosh. And yeah, so then it got to evolve.
Yeah, yeah. And it was neat because in terms of just thinking about the ways in which Frank Ocean is breaking down the canon, it gave me more of an opportunity to think about that from a more academic context and what it meant to have artists who are working in modes that are not as clearly defined by the established pedagogy and the idea that you're supposed to work in a certain fashion at a certain time. And that very much fit into the conversations that I've been having with people like Dow and Neil and the need for more of that kind of expression and more places in which we are putting that out into the world and with availability for artists.
And one of the things that I liked about looking at that, but also some of the other authors and writers included in the installation is, I see this frequently, I just feel like there is people pulling in their experiences of popular culture, but it is through such a very different lens than what is already out there. You know, I just feel like there is definitely a lens that writers of color have when you're interpreting, you're responding to the culture as you would to all experiences that you're coming into. So that's mm-hmm. really interesting, that connection to pop culture that is going to be so specific. Yeah. I think of who else comes to mind, but I'm like, it's really good at that. Oh, hello, Morgan Parker.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, her books, we have her book in the library, courtesy of Tin House.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that was lovely. We're going to take a little tiny bit of a break. We have pulled up someone who may or may not be in your particular exhibit, but again, it's all, you know, limited by space, of course. I pulled in a poet, Denise Froman, and this particular poem I loved and I've heard before. She's come to read and do workshops at Reed College earlier this year, too. This is the poem, Accents.
My mom holds her accent like a shotgun with two good hands. Her tongue, all brass-knuckled, slipping in between her lips. Her hips are all laughter and windclap. She speaks a sancocho of Spanish and English pushing up and against one another in rapid fire. See, there is no telling my mama to be quiet. My mama don't know quiet. Her voice is one size better fit all. And you best not tell her to hush. She waited too many years for her voice to arrive to be told it needed housekeeping. See, English sits in her mouth remixed. So strawberry becomes estrawberry. And cookie becomes a cookie. And kitchen, keychain, and chicken all sound the same. My mother doesn't say yes. She says, aha. And suddenly the sky in her mouth becomes a Hector Lavoe song. Her tongue can't lay itself down flat enough for the English language. It got too much hip, too much bone, too much gong, got too much cuatro to two-step, got too many piano keys in between her teeth. It got too much clave, too much hand clap, got too much salsa to sit still. It's be an anxious child wanting to make Play-Doh out of concrete. English be too neat for her kind of wonderful. Her words spill in conversation between women whose hands are all they got. Sometimes our hands are all we got, and accents that remind us that we are still bomba, still plena. You say, huepa.
Huepa.
You say, huepa.
Huepa.
And a stranger becomes your hermano. You say, dale.
Dale.
And a crowd becomes a family reunion. My mother's tongue is a telegram from her mother decorated with the coquis of El Campo. So even when her lips can barely stretch themselves around English, her accent is a stubborn compass, always pointing her towards home. Hmm.
Woo! that always brings me back home. I could just hear this. This was at the Near Reeking Cafe, and just like, just please, just all day long, you know? You're listening to Bread and Roses, and we still have folks from Decanon here today. I thought that it would be great. We had a little break to just kind of hear what I like most about playing sometimes readings where I hear the audience is, in that particular one, you're hearing Denise call out and there's a response. Like, people know and you're going to come back. And there's this response when, you know, she brings up Hector Laveau. And so that's like, that comes from lived experience. That comes from like, oh yeah, you just brought something from my culture into this. So could you tell me a little bit more about maybe some of the other events, maybe some of... I think it's important that when you've been putting on events with collaborators of color, you've also made sure to try to, that the audience is also as inclusive as it could be, right?
Definitely. Well, we're open to the audience being anybody really who's interested. I guess in our curation process for kind of figuring out what books, you know, to purchase for the library. This is a small library, so there's about 200 books in there. We actually had a process where we crowdsourced kind of essential lists from other writers and people in the community. And our idea was to end up with, and this is still kind of an ongoing project on the website, a list of writers' names on the website where you could find out more information about what they've published, but that you could also find out what they were reading or what they, you know, 10 books that they list in their decanon, we're calling it. And just as an interesting way of looking to the community to figure out what people are reading and what they're influenced by and how we can learn from each other. And Shayla was one of our contributors in that process. So Yes. We're definitely, Neil and I are the main facilitators for this particular piece of Decanon, but it's really what we hope to be, an open field where a lot of other writers of color and artists of color in our community can contribute, and we can grow this project to more.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely room for more people in the community to participate. It would be great for more people to reach out to the website, to share their ideas, to share articles that they have written or would like to write what's going on in the POC community when it comes to writing. My experience with working with Decanon has been that it's very open and broad, and we're trying to create this capacious resource that people of color can go to start thinking about writing from various aspects, whether it's that they want to see more performances being done by people that they feel are not being represented by other spaces, or if it's that they're just looking for resources to learn more about what's happening in literature. Because so often, I think many of us, whether the people that we're encountering are of color or not, there's often this conversation that people are having about, where can I find more writers of color? Where are the writers of color? Where are the writers of color that reflect me or reflect stories that I like to hear? And so Decanon is rooted in trying to provide those resources that people are looking for.
Yeah, and one of the things that we're trying to do on the website, which is also a conversation that Shayla was involved in, is the idea of the website becoming a resource for writers of color, like specifically Portland. So our focus is first like to profile the writing series that are POC run in Portland, or like the presses that publish POC or are POC run. So just sort of building that profile of our community and what we're doing. And I guess part of it is like creating a space for ourselves and using the resources, sharing our resources with each other. It's really a big part of it.
What I find really interesting about it is absolutely this particular crowd curation part of it, because it doesn't presume that you, Dao, and Neil are the ones deciding what goes in.
Yeah, that's definitely an important part of it. Like, we definitely, I don't think either of us is comfortable taking that sort of authority, and that's part of what we're resisting or trying to challenge with this whole concept of decanon, that there not it. There isn't necessarily one authority on the canon, and it has really multiple, you know, feeds into it.
Because it seems to me some of why whatever is considered canon now is because of particular gatekeepers.
Oh, definitely.
And even at the teaching level. So I'm just bringing up part of what was on the website is talking about MFA programs. So these writing, these creative writing programs that predominantly are not only run by, I mean, there's just how it's so few with faculty of color that you can actually just list them, right? You can actually... Right.
Yeah, Neil, do you want to talk about that post that you did
for DeCanon?
It's still in parts. It's a series.
There are three parts to it. And basically, I looked at all the graduate creative writing programs in the country and which ones had POC faculty and what they teach. And it was eye-opening in the end just how I could actually build that list. And it wasn't... it wasn't so overwhelming a number. And I've since gone back and dug deeper into the research, into the numbers. And it really does work out that it's only about 50% of the programs even have a writer of color on faculty. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of them have maybe one, possibly two. Yeah.
So tokenism is definitely taking place in a lot of these programs, you'd say?
I'd say there is a tendency that some people have of assuming that in addressing questions about diversity and representation, that the moment that they hire one faculty of color, they've achieved their goal of having representation. But in reality, I mean, it's not enough. It really isn't enough that we should be seeing more examples rather than putting the burden on the single faculty of color in a program to be, you know, assumed to be the authority on mm-hmm. everything, to lighten that load and to recognize them as individuals with their own areas of interest and also to represent sort of the plurality of experiences that are out there.
And there was one other, I feel like in your just doing that research right now, the statistic of those POC faculty, mm-hmm. How much of that particular like number are women?
Yeah, there's an interesting fact, which is that predominantly women that are the faculty of color in a program. And yet at the same time, the majority of programs that have faculty of color are still majority male. Mm. So it's a weird...
interesting dynamic.
It's a weird, weird dynamic.
Yeah. So sometimes, let's just say, depending on where someone lives or where someone's going, they kind of have to make a choice.
Yeah.
If they happen to be a woman, like a woman of color who wanted to pick a program for them in some ways.
Yeah, you might go to a program and you would find that, let's say there are three faculty of color in the program, that two of them will be male and one mm-hmm. of them will be female. But, but still, the likelihood of there being a female faculty of color in a program is still higher than there being a male faculty of color across all the programs that are out there.
I feel like that's like such a complicated subject.
It is.
A lot of factors that might be in play.
Yeah. There. Yeah. And I'm glad that you're doing that research so that people can have it. I'm glad that there are curated lists. That's another thing. I'm still a little bit surprised at the list there still right now is when we're looking at just the history of just of writing like American writers. I was hoping to be scrolling for a while through that list still. Are they, I mean, they're all, how would you put this? Are they all published writers that are on?
On the website? Mm-hmm. Well, that list is still very much in process.
Yes. Okay.
So there's a lot of names that we probably have not put on there, but we're just kind of, you know, putting up like definitely as many authors as we can, writers of color. And I think that our primary focus or what we'll be able to develop first will probably be like a more of a local, like regional Pacific Northwest mm-hmm. portrait mm-hmm. as far as like who the writers are in our area and in Portland. But the library, the a couple of things that have occurred to us, the books that are in the library right now, like we haven't listed on the website yet, but that is another post that we'll probably do so that people know like,
great.
You know, what's in the exhibit essentially right now.
Great, great. And we're going to definitely hear from all three of you. Yeah. I think we're going to start with Shayla. We're going to start with Shayla to have a little excerpt from a... We are so lucky. I just want to tell you guys, like, this is not even out yet, but we're going to get a taste of it today.
I'm so happy you're so excited about Frank Ocean.
Oh, come on.
I get so excited about Frank Ocean.
Come on.
So I am going to read one of the poems that I will be performing on the 19th for DeCannon's Music and Poetry event. If you want to hear it with the accompaniment of the song, you have to show up. So, you know, major plug. So this is in conversation with Frank Ocean's I Miss You. I miss you. Pablo asked me when I first knew I loved the ocean. He and I watch the waves at Hermosa ululate into grander versions of themselves until a wall reaches heaven like rafters. I fell in love the first time you took me snorkeling. I want to say I saw the metaphor, but I can't. I got so lost in the coral of my own breath, I could not feel the riptide carry me deep amidst the estuary. You grabbed me by the ankles, pulled me in the force of both your arms. I could have died then. I could have died right then, the ocean receding from my nose and eyelids, your heart flashing into me. When a wave breaks, there are only three means of encounter. Face the water head on, let it ball you like a car crash, swim away fast as you can, succumb.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, that's going to be really different with the music, the musical
imagine.
And then we're going to move over to Dow.
Okay. Let's see. Ooh, I had a page marked.
And this is, I'm so glad that it's going to be from this work, which is still a hybrid form, where what I liked about it, it's just doing something different with memoir that I was really excited to see.
Cool. Thank you. Did you have anything in mind for me to read? No. I have a passage marked.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Just, I will go with.
Well, I'm going to just read this passage that is from an essay in the piece, and it's about a return trip to Vietnam, which is part of my inheritance. I'm going to read this passage because part of, we had this question for the exhibit for DeCannon that we were asking ourselves or kind of posing to the other artists, which is what lies beyond or under or within language. So just really an open-ended question. And these are some thoughts I had on language. And this is kind of in, like, I wrote this essay on the anniversary of April 30th, which was the fall of Saigon. So just contemplating that event. The nature of words, the different naming of same points in history, the ways in which we do or do not inhabit the names, the first identities we are given, the ways we commemorate, define, try to claim ownership of events of the past, the ways we choose to remember or deny or silence or forget, these are all matters I'm wrestling with in being here. I don't have an easy take on it. All I can say for sure is language has its limitations. Language, from the very point we attempt to codify, capture, call it our own, or insist via our version of it, becomes potentially unreliable. The same event, traumatic movements of people on either side of a forming chasm, no matter how you choose to frame it, has no one definitive name, can really and truly be given no name, because maybe there are no words for it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to read a poem from Sarah Gambito's Matadora. This is Sarah Gambito is among many things a fantastic poet and educator, and also one of the original co-founders for Kundiman, which is an Asian American literary organization and retreat, of which I happen to be a fellow. So, Sarah's poem that I'm going to read is called "A Black Horse Has Come to You, Come to Your Sleep." You call the black horse father. You are followed all your life. There is a canyon. There is a lighted stage. There is a waiting audience. Write a poem in three stanzas. Describe below. One, describe the canyon from the stage. Two, describe the audience from the canyon. Three, describe the stage from the canyon. Four, make a horse run through all three stanzas.
Thanks. And just before we get back to that, since we're doing them all together, we're doing all the readings together, I was showing Neil this one poem that it's by Barbara Jane Reyes. And I showed him the poem and I'm just like, oh yeah, like I think I like, because I love reading it. And what did you say about it? You're like, oh, I could see you. Of course you would. You would pick that one. It is from her To Love as a Swung book. Now I gotta get in it. Okay.
Channel your Barbara.
Hey, it's not that hard. I love saying this. It's from her poem To Spit Fire. We spit fire, girl. We golden in the breath. We palabra, pinay, know that we legit. We speak our peace in the letting, rejoice. We file our fangs, girl, we got to bite down. We loosen our grip, we widen our sight. We street smart, whip smart, word is our bond. We diwa, pinay, our psalms be our salt. We diva, diwata, our voices for real. We badass, we deep, our birthright, our roar. We surge and swell, sing holy and sutra. We cut, snap, strike, we know damn, hot air. We handle ourselves, we are own, we be. We say our names, we say no, we say no. We spit fire, girl, we golden, we got this. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah. As another person would say, poem. Period. Jenna Marie Fletcher, you are a treasure. Thank you for that. I wanted to, in other times that we've had Bread and Roses shows where we've done live readings, we've definitely started out with the readings first and then discussion. But I really liked being able to really get a sense and a context for what Decanon was before we got into it. So thank you for getting into that a little bit. And would you say that, so some of what I've also seen with some of the events is it really allowed for an opportunity to kind of see how we, I don't want to call it, we don't write all the same. but bringing it back to what Neil said about this kind of expectation that if you are on faculty in these MFA programs and you happen to be one of the few people of color in that faculty, that there might be this expectation that you have to write about your racial or ethnic or, mm-hmm. you know, your specific experience as that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And sometimes someone will just say, no, I write all about my queerness, or I want to write about this. I'm not going to be writing about this. I know about Neil and the stuff. Some of that is technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I find that it would be disingenuous if I didn't write about my experiences as a programmer, because it was a big part of my life. And I think of other books in the DCannon archive. There's Todd Kaneko's Dead Wrestler Elegies, which are all about pro wrestling. And
that was a good pull.
But there are such a range of experiences and pop culture references that mean different things to different people. I think we talked about earlier Morgan Parker's book.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the key, I guess, things to think about would be that just because you have, say, one Vietnamese American writer on a faculty or in a group of people does not mean that you're really getting a representative of the Vietnamese American experience. And maybe part of the average American readership's like expectations is that they can read just a few books or something by, mm-hmm. you know, they can get the Asian American experience encapsulated in like, you know, these four authors who are really popular. So Neil said the word plurality earlier, and I think that's a big part of what this project is trying to realize, like mm-hmm. that and just that aspect of multi-storied, that the DCannon really is multi-storied. So hopefully, like, if each of us as readers, like, does our work as readers, we'll come away with a sense of every experience being really multifaceted, and that there's really no way to, like, encapsulate it in one story or easily define it.
Yeah, I think it kind of reminds me of the shape of the bookshelf that you curated, mm-hmm. That the bookshelf itself lacks a lot of hierarchy. It lacks yeah. the idea mm. that we're supposed to align with certain spaces. Yeah. As mentioned before, the idea that some of the shelves only fit one particular book. I think yeah. all of that is very metaphoric of the experience of what DCannon is trying to do with our understanding of literature by people of color. And when you go into these programs, so often what they are trying to do is put you in a position where you are the spokesperson. And this happens not mm-hmm. just with this happens with faculty of color in the same way that it happens with faculty that are not, that a lot of times they are often pushing us toward this idea that we're supposed to be all-encompassing of an experience that we're supposed to be representative of. And mm-hmm. we all know that experience is vastly broad. And on top of that, to make these distinctions, to say that being a technology writer is not a part of the Asian American canon, or to say that, you know, that it's not a part of the African American canon yeah. or the Pan African canon, or, you know, it's absurd. And I think a lot of what we're trying to do is break down some of that absurdity by mm-hmm. allowing people to see the multifaceted way in which all of these writers are working.
I think non-hierarchical is a great another yeah. term. Like, it's very much horizontal rather than vertical. Mm-hmm. Like, this is part of what we're trying to embrace. And I think that that just, you know, if we're really going to address, like, society as a multicultural, like, experience, we have to be able to accept all of that, those confluences and just different stories. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be able to accept horizontality, that mm-hmm. a lot of us are working on a continuum.
And I think that's really intimidating and just, like, exhausting for some people who would like to be able to, you know, compartmentalize or just not have to do that work.
Mm-hmm. I think about, you know, to me it's the experience, the difference between the anthology mm-hmm. and a space like Kundiman or Cave Canem or Cantamundo, where an anthology presumes a certain idea about the people it's collecting together and tries to define sort of this common ground. But it might actually be an illusion. It might not actually be that all Asian Americans write about the same immigrant narrative, because mm-hmm. it turns out we don't. Mm-hmm. We write about other things. Mm-hmm. And but walking into a space like Kundiman or Cave Canem or Cantamundo can be extremely liberating, because there is a realization, a confrontation with the fact that it is a far more complicated and vibrant and different field out there, full of voices, experiences, and approaches that are not what you have seen in the books or in the syllabi or in the anthologies that people have tried to teach you about what you're supposed to sound like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am so impressed. I'm you know, where someone might be intimidated. I'm so amazed by the work that's already been put into it. Even though, you know, I'm fully aware that there's still so much more, that it is an ongoing process to keep doing this, right? And I'm looking at it and just thinking, wow, there's very little excuse left now for other people when they're curating writers for conferences, for anthologies, for other things, but especially for events where you invite and you reach out. You're already a web, you know, you are a web kind of resource that people don't have to be from here. They can look to this. I'm just thinking of just that recent news, and I think is it Minneapolis? There was a writers' conference that was canceled because out of about 20 or so writers invited that were going to be confirmed at this conference, there was only one person of color, and he was Cuban American. And so they canceled it.
Yeah, it's the Loft. Yeah, I just... there really should be no excuse for...
No, that's unbelievable.
For making that effort to... I guess I just think of it from the perspective of readers. Like, what can a reader do? Mm-hmm. What is the work that a reader can do? Just, you know, even a non-writer or just a person. And I feel like even for myself, you know, I'm a person of color, but there's still like a lot of reading that I can do. And this project has been, educational in that way too, where it's introduced me to a lot, like through our research process, to a lot of other titles and books that, you know, I haven't read. So it's an ongoing process, I think.
Feels like there's also a new, there already is in some informal fashion community of writers that existed, but especially with this, it seems like there's people are maybe strengthening the bonds that they had in the community, you know, other writers of color coming together.
I think there's just so much more visibility for writers of color now. I mean, it's so atrocious to hear that something like they had to cancel a conference because, well, I mean, look, if we look at the last 5 years, if we look at who has been winning the Pulitzer and the Ruth Lilly and the National Book Awards, and these are writers of color. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is an entire world out there in which we are really finding strength and power and vocalizing it within the world of literature, and we're out there winning all of the major awards. We're out there just crushing it right now. So the idea that anyone would say, I can't find a writer of color for miles, just, you're not trying. You don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really has to be something like that.
Yeah, they don't want like their concept of reality threatened.
Mm-mm.
But I think that Shayla, we were talking about this at the last like meeting that we had together, where we're talking about just the fact that this is Portland, and we know that Portland's a very white place. And at the same time, there are a lot of writers of color. There's like a pretty strong community mm-hmm. here doing a lot of really excellent and interesting work. And that's part of what, you know, if we come together, we can talk about we're all doing
and
support each other.
And that's what's great about it. Sorry for everyone who's listening, who's not in Portland, that can't go to these events right now.
They can go online.
Yeah. There's definitely, we're already halfway practically through a lot of your events that you've started. It's only August 11th, but the stuff coming up, there's events this weekend.
Yeah, this weekend, I'll be running a workshop tomorrow, actually, Saturday, 12 until 2 at the Una Gallery, which is, as mentioned before, 328 Northwest Broadway Avenue, Suite 117. And then following that, from 3 to 5, there will be a discussion with the podcasters for Unlearning, the Unlearning Project, and they will be talking about, well, they'll be, yeah. Dal might be able to explain that a little better.
It's the brainchild of Bialica and Jeff Jickle, and it's a new project that they're just starting called the Unlearning Podcast, and this is actually going to be their first conversation, and they're going to record it, and they're going to talk about the process of unlearning, which, you know, can be unlearning a lot of processes, unlearning dominant patterns, unlearning, you know, just false realities. And that sort of relates thematically to what DeCannon is also exploring. So they're going to talk about that from 3 to 5 at UNA tomorrow afternoon.
It's so simple because it's right there on the corner. Yeah. So you just can't, you know.
Yeah. And then I think we should also mention on Sunday, the 13th, from, do you know what time they're starting?
Moved by Words
is hosting a Sunday morning brunch by Words, which is going to be what it sounds like.
I believe it's 11, starts at 11, okay, runs until 2.
And they're just going to be reading from the DeCannon Library. There's a couple readers, and that's and then there's also coffee and brunch snacks. Claudia Savage and Amy Temple Harper, I believe. Mm.
And a lot of this can also be found not just on Facebook, but on DeCannon's website, which is de-cannon.com. So that's the actual punctuation, you guys.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Do you want us to talk about the other events?
Oh, please. We're going to keep reminding everybody that they have to hear the musical accompaniment to what we just heard earlier.
Well, first, on August 16th, on Wednesday night, there's going to be a film screening of a film called Haft Scene. It's a short film, and it's a collaboration between Roland Darwin Wu, Jonathan Raisi, and Stacey Tran. And it's excellent, and they're going to be projecting it in the space. So that will happen at 8 p.m. on the 16th.
And then the 19th
is actually. And then the 19th, I think we're going to be starting at 8 p.m., roughly like 8 to 11 time frame. We're going to be doing music and poetry performance. And that's with Shayla Lawson, Trevina Brings Plenty, Anna Vo, Tron 444, and myself, Dow Strom. And then do you want to talk about the closing event, the August 26th?
Closing event, we close with a reading group that is being hosted, sponsored by the Physical Education Movement Group.
Yeah.
And we will have links to the readings on the website.
They do a really unique format of reading group discussion. And so basically we have chosen, like, you know, amid all this, we've chosen some articles and links, and some of it's online YouTube videos and some of it's just like PDF files, and those will be posted on our website and also on Physical Education's website. I think they're physicaleducation.life, I think. I'm not totally sure. And they are an experimental movement group. So the discussion is just a really open, like, you can read as much of the materials as you want. They're accessible online, and then just come to the library and discuss. And
yeah, Lou is in that.
Yes.
Yeah. So this was such a pleasure, such an honor. I'm so glad that we were able to even just get a little sample of just what is in there. I think that's what's daunting about trying to bring this on in a radio format, is just trying to cover the scope of what you've been doing. So thank you so much for doing this project.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
thank you.
You've been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to be going out on This Is Actually Dow. You can find the particular song that we're having on Dow's Bandcamp. So it's just finding Dow Strom on Bandcamp.
Bandcamp.com.
Mm-hmm. And this particular, it's Color, I think, of Spring.
Color of Spirit is the
Color
title
Spirit.
Of the song.
Mm-hmm. And so this is just great to go out on. And thank you so much. We're on every Friday evening. We'll be out there again. Come back next Friday. Thank you.
This is Tevin, your host here at Combined Culture Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Jalen, Super Ultra Extra, your co-host. And here at Combined Culture, we're here to touch on multiple aspects of the culture.
Our first show is Wednesday, August 16th at 7 p.m. Tune in to spread the culture.
This is KBOO Portland.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready?
Give this time.